Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. Lale Khalili returns to Behind the News to talk about the murky structures of the global shipping business that coverage of the Ever Given somehow forgot to explore. And then LaDonna Pivetti from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities will discuss the merits of subsidizing employment for low-wage workers. Today's interviews are on the short side, which gives me a chance to hold forth for a bit, which is something I haven't done for a while. The economy is slowly recovering from the corona shock, though it still has a bit of territory to traverse just to get back to where we were in February 2020. But judging from asset prices, you'd never know we're still in a hole. The history of capitalism has been one of many bubbles, some more consequential than others, especially when they burst, but I don't recall any other time where we've seen so many simultaneously. Stocks, of course, but also Bitcoin, NFTs, fancy sneakers, and in a throwback to 15 years ago, housing. Housing is getting less attention than some other things, but the combination of pandemic flight from cities, tight supplies, and low mortgage rates have produced quite a boom. It's not 2006, the peak of a great early millennium housing bubble. It's looking more like early 2004, but we're ascending from serious peaks. Over the last year, the national S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller Index, the best measure of housing prices we have, is up over 11%. Phoenix is up 16%, Seattle 14%. Prices are even up in the metros reportedly subject to pandemic flight. San Francisco and New York, up double digits. These are the kinds of gains we were seeing in 2004. Recent price surges have taken the national price index and some metropolitan areas close to or even past 2006 bubble peaks. When adjusted for inflation by the consumer price index, the S&P CoreLogic National Index is just 1.5% below the May 2006 peak. But there's wide geographic variety in house prices relative to that peak. Denver is 34% above, Dallas 30%, Seattle 23%. Some cities that were the center of that bubble are still well short of their spectacular peaks. Phoenix is 22% below, Miami 25%, and Las Vegas 30%. But the general picture is one of exuberance, rational or not. Of course, incomes are higher now than they were 15 years ago, so we'd expect some rise in prices over time. If you compare house prices to rents as a way of judging whether prices are high or low, you also get that 2004 feeling. The ratio is now right where it was early in that year. But that comparison now is to a measure that's seen substantial growth itself. The rent subindex of the CPI is one of the few areas that have shown a lively inflation. Since 2015, rents are up 23% nationally, almost twice as much as the overall CPI. During the early 2000s housing bubble, there was little such rent inflation. So this valuation measure is elevated despite persistent growth in rents. Owners and renters alike have no shelter from rising prices. Oddly, this is all happening when over 9 million owners say they're not current on their mortgages and over 8 million are behind in their rent. You'd almost think that capitalism is not a great way to provide for one of life's essentials, housing. Continuing in a mini-survey of capitalism's deficiencies, we see some serious shortfalls in investment. Investment, public and private, is what's supposed to drive productivity, which in turn drives prosperity. Reality is a bit more complicated, but let's stick with the catechism for now. Neither the public sector nor the private sector has been doing much investment. Here I'm going to talk mostly about net investment, what remains after deducting depreciation, the devaluation of the existing capital stock because of wear and tear and obsolescence. In a healthy economy, we should be seeing high levels of net investment. The public sector should be investing in infrastructure, and the private sector in buildings and equipment. But we're not. Both businesses and governments are barely investing enough to keep up with normal rot. Private net investment peaked in the 1970s and has been declining ever since. Public civilian net investment peaked in the 1960s and has been on a downtrend since. Measured as a share of GDP, the great post-recession average of net public investment is just a hair above what it was in the 1940s, a decade when civilian spending was squeezed by World War II. Net private investment has been scraping the bottom for years and fell further in 2020. The decline was the result not only of a fall in gross investment, before depreciation that is, but a rise in the rate of depreciation. That rise in depreciation relative to gross investment suggests an increasing bias towards short-lived, quicker payback equipment. Capitalists, whose profits are theoretically justified by a willingness to take risk, aren't showing many propensities towards nerve. Net public investment rose slightly last year, but it's still in the dumps. Federal investment was 0% of GDP, which is where it's been almost every year since 1989. In other words, Uncle Sam is investing just enough to replace stuff as it falls apart, but no more. And judging from appearances, we might not even be doing that. State and local government, where most of the public infrastructure action is doing a bit more, but its rate of net investment over the last decade has been half the 1950 to 99 average. Much of that can be explained by post-Great Recession austerity, but that austerity was barely shaken as the economy recovered from the shock. According to a Standard & Poor's report published in October, had state and local government infrastructure spending continued at the rate prevailing before the Great Recession, cumulative investment would have been $1.5 trillion higher than it was. As S&P put it, that missed opportunity contributed to a decade of slower economic growth, missed productivity gains, and deferred maintenance that increases the cost of deferred capital projects. Next to that $1.5 trillion shortfall, Biden's proposed $2 trillion infrastructure scheme looks a lot less grand. More on that in the coming weeks. What's behind the weakness in private investment? One attempt at an answer is a recent paper published by the think tank American Compass, which describes itself as consisting of a team with years of experience in some of America's preeminent conservative institutions. So these aren't a gang of bullshies. In that paper, the think tank's executive director, Orrin Cass, looked at the investment record of all publicly traded U.S. corporations from 1971 to 2017 and sorted them into three categories. Growers, firms that need outside financing to fund their capital expenditures. Sustainers, firms that invest in excessive depreciation and also return cash to their shareholders. And eroders, firms that consume capital faster than they invest while still returning cash to their shareholders. And that return of cash generally takes the form of stock buybacks or ordinary dividends. The first kind, the grower, is an archetypical user of the financial markets, as Cass puts it. The second is the archetypical capitalist enterprise, and the third is a strange type of firm that seems to harvest its own organs for its shareholders' short-term benefit. That's his race, not mine. The number of eroders has risen dramatically. From 1971 to 1985, sustainers averaged 82% of the total value of the stock market, and eroders just 6%. In 2017, sustainers accounted for 40% of the market, and eroders 49%. These findings aren't driven by the transition to low-investment industries, that is, the replacement of manufacturing by services. Within manufacturing, the eroder share rose from 7% in the earlier period to 47% in recent years. Within the information sector, the eroder share rose from 2% to 52%. Looked at in another way, in Cass's words, the share of GDP flowing out of the operating economy has risen steadily. He doesn't say it exactly, but what he's referring to is how corporations have been shoveling out trillions of dollars to their shareholders over the last 40 years instead of investing, hiring, or researching. That outflow has made for an investment shortfall that Cass estimates at $3.1 trillion. Add together a $1.5 trillion shortfall in state and local government investment and a $3.1 trillion shortfall in private investment, and you're talking some serious money. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear about the shipping business.
Be amazed, yeah, yeah.
Some of Me and My Dog by Boy Genius. I Want to Be Emaciated is an arresting line, though I'm not necessarily convinced of its desirability. Now, global shipping. It's not every day that a ship as long as the Empire State Building is high gets stuck in the Suez Canal and messes with global shipping for a week. An average of 50 ships a day pass through that canal, carrying some $10 billion worth of goods, accounting for an eighth of international trade. Those ships keep getting bigger. The Ever Given, the troublesome vessel, is about 15 times the size of the pioneer container ships of the late 1960s. Ships that size can make trouble, but the industry loves them because they're more profitable. Though it might have been a good occasion to look at the murky industry, what Bob Fitch used to call the capitalist hyena press didn't bother. The industry consists of a maze of often opaque legal and institutional arrangements. To do the exploratory work, here's Lale Khalili, a professor of international politics at Queen Mary University in London. Her book, Sinews of War and Trade, published by Verso, is an examination of the contribution of shipping to the development of capitalism in the Middle East. Lale Khalili. The meme industry worldwide is now really struggling for a new subject, and this ship has been freed. Couple of questions that I don't think have been adequately addressed in the mainstream coverage of it. What is the legal structure behind this ship? Who owns it? Who runs it? And then who staffs it?
So the Ever Given is the perfect example of the way global shipping is set up today. Ever Given is operated by Evergreen, which is a massive one of the top 10 shipping companies in the world, which is based out of Taiwan. The ship itself, so the actual physical object, is owned by a Japanese company. The agents that service the ship when it arrives into port or leaves the port are based in Dubai, and they're actually a long-standing, their history runs back into British colonialism. And the company that sort of manages the management of the ship and its, the crew that's on board and other kinds of day-to-day management of this stuff is actually based out of Germany. But in addition to all of those, or despite all of those, one doesn't know which way to say this, the ship flies the flag of Panama. So what that means is that the ship is registered in Panama, despite its ownership in Japan, operation in Taiwan, and management by a German firm. It actually flies the flag of Panama. And the flag of Panama is probably the single most significant flag among those that the International Transport Workers Federation has called flags of convenience. Flags of convenience, or open registries, are devices that are set up to allow for offshore registration of ships. And as the wonderful essayist of New Yorker wrote, the convenience being, John McPhee wrote about the flags of convenience, he said the convenience being you pay lower wages, you don't follow environmental regulations, you have lower thresholds for insurance, and you pay no taxes. And so that convenience is, of course, a convenience for capital accumulation. And what is really striking about the flags of convenience, Panama, as I said, was being one of the most significant, but also among them Liberia, Marshall Islands. When I say those names, of course, what becomes clear is that most of the states that have these flags of convenience, or most of the ones that are the most successful flags of convenience, the ones that have the most ships registered to them, are major clients of the U.S. And the establishment of these flags of convenience in the early 20th century was essentially another factor in bolstering U.S. At the time, hemispheric, but eventually planetary kind of imperial control. So originally, some of these flags of convenience were established to actually escape, that they were for booze cruises, if you want, to escape prohibition laws. But then suddenly the businesses figured out that this is actually really quite a convenient way to lower the wages of seafarers, to essentially escape the laws established, for example, the Jones Act, that requires ships that are touching the U.S. coastal trade have American crews. And so it ended up being that in the 1920s and 30s, the two companies that used flags of convenience, and particularly of Panama and Costa Rica the most, were the banana boats of the United Fruit and the tankers of Standard Oil of California. And so that sort of gives you a sense of what the significance of these flags of convenience has been historically, and the legal infrastructure, why it was set up, and how it operates even today.
Now, why the separation of the owner and the operators? Is like the separation of ownership and control in the stock market?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I think there's a series of reasons for that. I think part of the reason for this is that the separation of the owner and operator allows for some shipping companies to essentially own the ships and just charter them out to different kinds of operating companies. The business is very different when you're actually operating freight carriage. So carrying freight from one location to another location, making the kinds of deals that you need to make, that sort of stuff tends to be it tends to be a very different kind of business than simply owning a ship and chartering it out. But there's another reason for this as well. The sort of the degrees of risk and profit are very different in these businesses. And interestingly, those companies that own the physical ships rather than sort of the chartering for the carriage tend to have tend to be able to take on a little bit more risk in ordering these ships, but then also scrapping them. Whereas the freight companies charter them based on the shifts in global trade. So it's really interesting, for example, to see that not just container firms do this, of course, oil companies and oil carriers do it too. But the example that I think is really interesting for me is that British Petroleum decided to, for example, start chartering tankers from someone else in order to have to avoid having tankers when oil prices were low sitting idle. So it takes on different kind of business management risk issues and also, of course, different kinds of business connections for these two different sides of the business.
Now, this ship was quite large, right? Not perhaps the largest in the world, but what's been happening to the size of these ships, and are they just outgrowing waterways like the Suez Canal? Are they just getting too big?
So it's quite interesting. I mean, of course, the massive increase in ship sizes is really a kind of a major response to the economies of scale, right? And the original moment at which ships started to get so massive, ships started to get so much bigger, recognizably so, it was actually when the Suez Canal shut down the first time in 1958 because of the tripartite war by France, Britain, and Israel against Egypt when Gamal Abdel Nasser nationalized the canal. And this was, of course, a moment at which enormous amounts of oil was flowing from the Middle East to Europe. Europe was undergoing, this was a major decade during which industrial production was ramping up again, reconstruction was ramping up again after the Second World War. And so the oil carriers didn't really want to be sitting there, and so they had to sort of reroute their ships around the Cape of Good Hope. But that at the time added 2 to 3 weeks to each of the journeys if you actually went fast. And so in order to compensate for that extension of the time that it took, they took on the bigger, much bigger ships, which, as I said, it allowed for economies of scale. Now, what is really interesting is that for reasons of physics, but also reasons of cost benefit, etc., ships can get up to a certain length, and then beyond that, it's actually they haven't quite figured out whether they can make it much longer, because also having far too long a ship could potentially, in places like, for example, the Bay of Biscay, which has very stormy weather and really tall waves, it could potentially result in ships, for example, if they're too long, snapping. So one of the things that has been happening is that ships have hovered around 400 meters or 1,300 feet for the last few decades, but they have gotten progressively wider. And of course, what that translates into is that they can carry more containers, they can carry more oil, they can carry more other cargo. And so that means that their draft, so the part of the ship that's underwater, becomes deeper and deeper. The ship gets wider, and of course it's now at 1,300 feet. And so what is really interesting is that while this economies of scale means profit for the private firms, it is the public fixed infrastructures like canals, like ports, like kind of unloading businesses that have to actually constantly expand to accommodate these expanding ships. So they take on, essentially, this is a kind of a, if you will, a kind of an indirect subsidy for the shipping companies, for the carriers of various kinds of freight.
Why didn't this happen before? The ships have been getting much larger for decades. Why didn't one get stuck in the Suez before?
ships have gotten stuck before. So I think that the longest that another ship got stuck was in 2004 for 4 days or some such. And so I think there's a kind of history of these kinds of things happening. But in that instance, they were able to, I believe they may have pumped some of the fuel out of it. And so it was much easier to refloat it because it was much easier to make it a lighter ship. Whereas in this instance, with a ship that looked very, very laden, and the capacity of Ever Given is about 20,000 20-foot equivalent containers, it's much more difficult to sort of get the necessary equipment to bring about to take the containers off the ship. And so I think this is the kind of issues that have existed. We haven't heard about it because it's also been a shorter period of time. This time, I think the fact that it was nearly a week that this the canal was blocked due to commercial reasons, due to a ship grounding, has given us a lot of attention. I also do have to say that the meme thing that you mentioned has also been a factor in this, because that other instance of a tanker getting stuck was, I think, in the early 2000s, where memes and social media were nothing like what we have today. And so I think that that also actually has made the grounding much more of a thing, if you will, this time. But I also do have to say, I saw a tweet by somebody who was saying that it's very difficult when you're thinking about the working of the market to understand things such as shorting the market or blockchains or credit swaps, whereas a ship blocking the Suez Canal and causing waves in the global economy is a much more physically understandable. And I suspect that there is part of the attraction of the event, part of the reason that people have made memes about it, part of the reason that it's become such a sort of an item leading the news has been precisely because of its accessibility, because of its legibility, because of its understandability.
It's funny because, you know, we heard so much in the late 90s and, you know, some revival of this in recent years about being post-material. Things don't matter anymore. We're all weightless and all that nonsense. Clearly, this is a reminder that that's just not true.
Alan Sekula, the great Marxist essayist and photographer, actually writes about precisely this, you know, 20 years ago. And it is, you know, 90% of the goods that we have, it's the statistics that everybody that talks about global trade throws around, but 90% of the goods that we have travels on ships. It is, despite the fact that we think a lot of trade takes part in the ether or via air cargo, maritime transport is so physically in your face. And at the same time, we don't see it all the time. We don't, unless it breaks down like it has, people often don't think about it. And so I think that physicality is something that actually, that materiality, if you will, is also what makes it really interesting and attractive. But I also do want to say that while there is also a lot of material here, the virtual itself is, of course, also material. We know that those data centers, for example, you know, are very solid things. They're not just waves in ether. And very significantly, the pricing of routes on lots of these shipping routes is set not only through spot prices or through calculation of how much it costs to carry something from point A to point B, but through sort of the financial instruments that also feed into that price setting. There are, you know, derivatives on routes. There are options on routes and on different kinds of cargo. And so I think that that's also quite important. The materiality of shipping is also interwoven with the virtual or with the financial or with the not immediately visible.
I'm speaking with Lale Khalili, author of Sinews of War and Trade, Shipping and Capitalism in the Arabian Peninsula, published by Verso. Speaking of materiality, I'm curious about who staffs these ships, because when I was a merchant seaman briefly back in the early 70s, there were about 40 of us on an old World War II era Liberty ship that had been converted into a container ship. I imagine the crews are much smaller relative to the size of the ship now, but how many would be on a ship like this, and where do they come from? What's their nationality?
This particular ship, because it's flagged to Panama, chances are that the crew are from places like Indonesia or India or China. And chances are, again, we don't know yet. I'm sure that we'll find out in short, once things have kind of cleared out, that possibly the officers could also be from Russia or Ukraine or also India or possibly the Philippines. When I went down the Suez Canal, I went down the Suez Canal a couple of times on container ships. One of the container ships that I was on was about the same size as this one. So it was 390 meters long, so about 10 meters or 30 feet shorter than the Ever Given. And that ship had 30 crew members and 5 passengers on it. So a massive ship about the size of Ever Given had 30 crew members. Now, on that ship, the officers were from the former Yugoslavia. So there were Croatian and a couple of Montenegrins on that ship. And the crew were Filipino. And Philippines has been, until very recently, the number one producer of a kind of a seafaring diaspora, if you will, of all the seafarers. It was the largest supplier of seafarers in the world. It has now been surpassed by China. But interestingly, ships that are flagged to European flags or to non-flag of convenience flags tend to take on Filipino crew members and Western European or Balkan seafarers, and flags of convenience tend to have crew members from places where they don't have to pay wages that are quite as high as those that the Filipinos demand, which is still lower than the wages that, for example, Montenegrin or Croatian officers receive.
Going back to my experience in the Merchant Marine in the early 70s, we were paid union scale American wages. What are the wages like now?
I would say that a Filipino able seaman probably earns around $1,000 a month on a European flagged ship. It's probably a little bit less than that elsewhere. And of course, the more seniority you have as a crew member, you probably earn a bit more than that. I think that with the officers, again, for a ship flagged to Europe, depending on seniority, you can command anywhere between $2,500 a month to about $4,000 or $5,000 a month if you're a captain. But again, those wages are again dependent on the nationality of the crew members, but and also very significantly on the flag that the ship flies. One of the statistics that I actually found somewhere from 1982, and statistics about this are a little bit hard to come by because, of course, a lot of these shipping companies don't want to tell you what the sort of the wage rates are. But there was a notice that Exxon had sent around that when they took one of their ships from a U.S. flag to a flag of convenience, they were able to save several hundred thousand dollars in wages for that year.
Last time we talked, I believe that was over the summer, about your book. The pandemic had pretty much stalled an awful lot of shipping, and the crews were often stranded in ports. Has that situation resolved itself? What's happened to shipping as the pandemic has receded somewhat?
A lot of cruise ships and cruise ship crews were stranded in ports. With freighters, a lot of freighters were actually moving in ports, rather interestingly. And those seafarers that had been stuck on board the ship because they had come to the end of their contracts actually could not disembark because many of the ports and airports were closed. And so the seafarers were not allowed to leave either the ship or indeed to fly home because so many of the airlines weren't operating. So you actually found at some stage, I think the International Transport Workers Federation and the International Chamber of Shipping, so the bosses and the workers' representatives, agreed that there were probably about 400,000 seafarers that had come to the end of their contracts but had not been able to go home. Now, as ports and airports began to open and as airlines began to fly back, some of that backlog cleared. But at some stage, there were people that were on board these ships that had worked already for 11 months, which is supposed to be the sort of the maximum length of the contract they have on board the ship, and yet they had been on the ship for up to 18 months, and those latter 7 months they had been unpaid. So obviously they were fed and they had a ship's roof over their head, but they were unpaid and in wages. And so it was kind of a horrific situation. What was again, the backlog on that has cleared a bit. What is interesting and troubling, of course, is that the shipping companies have nevertheless profited. So one of the striking things about this pandemic has been that regardless of what happened in the pandemic, the shipping companies seem to have made profits around this. And Olaf Merk, who's a who's an analyst for the OECD on transportation, on these forms of transportation, essentially has pointed out that when the pandemic started and there was this all this panic over supply chains, of course, that meant that freight costs ended up going up, which, of course, benefits the shipping companies. And then when the pandemic ended and containers weren't where you wanted them to be, there was a shortage of containers in ports, there was congestion in a lot of ports, like Los Angeles and Long Beach had a congestion such that many of the ships were rerouting to Northern California and to further north. Again, that those kinds of things resulted in increases in freight prices. So no matter what happened, the shipping companies were raising freight prices and benefiting from this. At the very moment at which, for example, there were unwaged seafarers sitting on ships and waiting to go home. So it's been a really interesting moment to watch these developments.
Now, I saw a bunch of maps of ships around the world and, you know, the moving in response to the blockage of the Suez Canal. And there's so many ships on these maps. For someone who's an amateur to these things, the number of ships involved was really, really striking, constantly at sea. And this is a bit off topic, but the ecological impact of all this shipping must be really dark.
Yes, it is. It is hideous. And it's not just when accidents happen. So another ship that was flagged to Panama last year, MV Wakashio, actually crashed, grounded on the reefs in Mauritius, resulting in the spillage of fuel in this incredibly super sensitive ecosystem. Those kinds of groundings, of course, happen a lot, far more than we actually hear about. But even when those accidents are not happening, ships put out enormous amounts of climate damaging, the fuel that ships operate on is some of the heaviest gunk that comes out of the refinery products. It's the stuff that comes out of the bottom. It's like essentially the thing next to tar. And of course, that's going to produce enormous amounts of pollution, air pollution. And recently, the EU, for example, has put demands on reduction of sulfur levels on ships that are spewing essentially smoke out. Their smoke is supposed to be less sulfuric when they arrive in European ports. But that kind of regulation doesn't necessarily exist in all the ports. And so there's that air pollution. And then, of course, you have ships that illegally dump their ballast water, which is often mixed up with oil. It's not supposed to be, but it often is mixed up with oil, or dump their waste, both sort of the ship's running waste, but also the sort of the human waste from the humans that are on board the ship into the sea. And so you do have these extraordinary devastations. And that's not even coming to the kind of ecological damage that is done by the making of ports and extending of ports and making shipping channels and, you know, the ripping out the bottom of the sea and disturbing often quite sensitive coastal zones and the like.
Looking at the disruption that this one ship blockage caused, it struck me and many other people as well that militant workers who wanted to cause a fuss could really close off global trade quite easily by just closing a few choke points, right?
You would think so, and you would hope so. And interestingly, you would think that seafarers would be the one that would have this leverage. But I think I've talked to you about this before as well. Strikes among seafarers tends to be quite rare and has been quite rare in the last 10 or so years. And it's kind of inexplicable because port workers are actually quite militant and they continue to be militant and they continue to strike and can continue to shut down. And you know, there have been instances of, for example, blocking the boat in California for both political reasons and economic reasons. And so, you know, economic strikes, workplace strikes, but also political strikes. And so ports are much more open to these kind of choke points or counter-logistical forms of labor organizing seafarers don't seem to be. They used to be a very rowdy bunch. Of course, you know, the amazing work of Marcus Rediker and Peter Linebaugh against the connections across the Atlantic Ocean points to these histories of seafaring revolt. But for whatever reason, maybe because of the structures of global shipping, maybe because of the way that the ships now have these incredibly reduced number of staff on board, because of the way that contracts are staggered aboard the ship, and so people don't actually get to spend a huge amount of time together, because of the way that their time aboard the ship is pretty much constantly taken up with the tedium of work, one doesn't see that kind of a counter-logistical protest on board ships. But yes, if choke points were shut down, of course, you could really disrupt global trade. And some of the memes that were going around was about sort of comrade ever given, you know, blocking global trade. So,
but my memory, which again is decades old, but a lot of the people who are working on ships are rather odd and estranged from human society and perhaps don't have the most developed social ties.
My sense was that they were actually really quite a fun bunch, the ones that I got to meet and got to know. And I'm on a lot of forums, seafarer forums, and it seems to me that they're actually quite lovely people. I do think that it has changed in some very peculiar ways. So I was talking to people that had been seafarers on Dutch ships, and they were quite militant. They saw this as a kind of a professional occupation. They looked at this as a sort of a job to be proud of and invested in. And a lot of the other seafarers that I've spoken to see it as just a job, and they try to just get by, and the isolation aboard the ships. And again, it's perhaps because of that sense of isolation, because the ships have so few people on them, actually makes this not as an exciting an adventure as it might have been when Melville, for example, was writing about seafaring. I do think that the alienation that actually you and I were talking about before we started our interview, before we started recording, the alienation that has defined the world of work has particularly affected seafaring, because I do think that seafaring has this kind of a storied past, storied history. I mentioned Melville, but the writings of Melville shows this extraordinary shipboard solidarity. C.L.R. James, when he was writing about Moby Dick, he calls the ship an international of seafarers. And so he sees it as a kind of a global, as a possibility of global solidarity. I think that the alienation that has been really institutionalized within shipboard labor has stripped that down to quite depressing levels.
That was Laleh Khalili, author of Sinews of War and Trade, Shipping and Capitalism in the Arabian Peninsula, published by Verso. Her day job is as professor of international politics at Queen Mary University in London. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of the second movement of Mendelssohn's first string quartet performed by the Emerson Quartet. Next, subsidized employment. As the economy and job market slowly recover from the COVID crisis, there's still a lot of suffering about. Earlier I mentioned the 17 million people having trouble making their mortgage or rent payments. Almost 23 million say they're having trouble getting enough food. That's almost one out of every nine adults. The so-called American Rescue Plan Act will address some of these issues, but not all. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities has been urging the creation of a subsidized jobs program to offer employment to those who have a hard time in any job market, but especially in one like this. What might such a program look like? Here's LaDonna Pavetti, Vice President for Family Income Support at the Center, with more. LaDonna Pavetti. So let's just start with some big picture stuff. Wall Street and people who follow it are convinced that things are getting better. The economy is recovering. We could have another 500,000 jobs reported for March or even more. Some people are saying up to 1 million. I guess basically they're saying everything is, if not okay now, it's on its way to being okay. What do you say to that?
We do hope that things will start to pick up. But we know that in recoveries, there are always people left behind, and the people who are left behind tend to be, are more likely to be people with lower skills, less work experience, people of color. So we need to be thinking about that moving forward, there's a strategy of making sure that if we really want an equitable recovery, we need to think about what do we know from previous recoveries about who's left behind and how can we actually make sure that they're not left behind again.
And how much do we know about how people are making ends meet? Can they pay their bills? Are they able to put food on the table, pay the rent?
No, they cannot. We have seen just extraordinarily high levels of food insecurity, so people not having enough to eat, a very high level of people not being able to cover their rent and other expenses. So we are seeing just really unprecedented levels of hardship.
And what do you think of what are we calling it, the American Rescue Act? What do you think of the provisions in the that act?
So the American Rescue Act has a lot of provisions that really should make a difference for people helping to make their ends meet and being able to meet some of those. So there are huge investments to be able to help people pay for back rent and try and to avoid evictions and people becoming homeless. There are some resources for people to be able to for catching up on utility bills. There are some flexible resources for state and localities to be able to both cover things that they have had to cut back on as well as being able to meet unmet needs. There's substantial investments in child care to be able to rebuild our child care system. There are a continuation of unemployment benefits. There are additional payments to families, and there is an increase in the child tax credit and the earned income tax credit, which will get cash to families to be able to, again, meet their basic needs.
And a lot of these things are temporary, though, right?
Yes, many of them are temporary. That is absolutely true.
So what are the prospects for getting some of these things written into stone?
I think we don't know that yet. I think that that's sort of the next challenge is trying to really sort of more make some changes permanent so that we can help families on an ongoing. One of the things we know is that some of the families who are struggling were already struggling, so there was no room in their budgets for the extra costs and the extra sort of length of unemployment. And so trying to sort of help people over the long term is definitely on the agenda for the long term, and we'll see where that goes. But that is sort of the next step, is really thinking about long-term investments and how do we maintain those.
Center on Budget and Policy Priorities has been putting out a couple of reports on the idea of subsidized employment. First of all, could you define the concept?
So subsidized employment is a strategy where you use government funds to pay people for working. So it really is, when I started talking about the importance of having really thinking about an equitable recovery and how do you help people who are left behind. It is a strategy for creating jobs that may not otherwise exist and to be able to target those to people who may not get hired in the first tranche of recovery.
So what kinds of jobs and what kinds of employers are we talking about here?
So it depends. In the last recovery, we had a very flexible subsidized employment program that created 260,000 jobs. States and localities had a lot of flexibility in how they did that. Some worked with small private sector employers who otherwise may not have stayed afloat. Some worked with government employers, and some worked with nonprofits. So it can be any kind of job. The idea is to really sort of try and identify jobs that would not otherwise exist and create jobs that are a match for the people who are being left out of jobs that are not subsidized.
And we're talking about private employers as well as public?
Yes, private, public, and nonprofit, all three in the past have participated in subsidized employment programs.
I would imagine some people on both the right and the left would find it a little difficult to swallow the idea of subsidizing private employers, aren't you just subsidizing low wages?
So part of the reason, and it depends, you can structure it in a way, two ways that really sort of help to create long-term pathways. So some states actually structured it so that they started out with paying a full wage and then over time cut back on that so that employers picked up more of the wage over time. So the idea is part of the reason for subsidizing private sector employers is to encourage them to hire people that they may not otherwise hire, to be able to give them opportunities that they may not have. And the other is that, again, in the last recession, what we saw was small employers who otherwise would have either gone out of business or been greatly impacted by their businesses being greatly reduced. So it really was a win-win for both the employer and for the individual.
This seems a contrast with, say, the PPP that came out in last year. That's aid to employers who swear they're going to keep people employed, but it's not clear they actually did that. This seems more targeted at actually creating jobs and sustaining them.
It is very targeted. It is very targeted at the money goes directly to individuals to cover their wages. So the employer is helped because they have less costs. And the individual was helped because they now have money coming in that they can use to pay their bills. The other thing that's important is subsidized jobs program always have non-displacement clauses. So it cannot replace a position that would have been already funded. It really is intended to either be a new position or a position that otherwise would be lost.
And are there some examples of these kinds of programs underway?
There are examples. One example is there's a program in San Francisco that has been in place for a long time, actually started during the recovery, which really has multiple dimensions to it. And they try and place people with various employers depending on their experience and needs. And that program was evaluated and shown to have significant impacts after 4 years. So not only got people a job in the short term, but also got people better wages in the long term. Another example is a program in Baltimore that really has worked with people in the community to help train them for healthcare jobs, dealing specifically with COVID. So that is a large program, again, that was started during COVID to really help sort of the dual goals of trying to create a stronger healthcare presence in neighborhoods as well as be able to provide jobs for people.
I'm interested that you said that this kinds of program seems to have long-term positive effects. And we know that people who are unemployed for a long time have more and more difficulty getting reemployed because their skills deteriorate and employers look askance at them. This sounds like that flips this over, and it actually improves people's prospects over the longer term.
It can. Now, we have sort of increasing evidence of the long-term impacts. What we have seen historically is that we always see increases in wages when people are employed and the job is subsidized. And we have new evidence showing these longer-term impacts. So it really does depend on how programs are structured. And so it's important, both there's an important part of matching people with the right jobs, and there is also providing supports to help people to be able to succeed in those jobs and providing the support at the end to help people transition into a job that is not subsidized. So the Baltimore example is a good example. They actually provide job coaching to people. So while people are in the job, they are helping them to think about their long-term prospects and helping them to build the skills to be able to compete in the unsubsidized job market.
Now, this sounds like a cousin of a job guarantee, a public jobs program. How is it related? How is it different? How do you feel about this kind of program relative to something broader like a job guarantee?
So I think that it is an issue about funding. So a subsidized jobs program has two things about it that I think distinguish it. One is it is generally smaller, so it is almost always a fixed pot of money. And the other is that it often is targeted to people with the most significant skill deficits. So you're really trying to reach a specific group of people to help them move back into the labor market. So it is, if you think about a continuum, a jobs guarantee is a much more expensive, much more expansive program. This is really a smaller sort of investment of trying to make sure that that some people are not left behind. It is always better to have a larger program, but that is a question of resources. And it doesn't mean if you can't get to the point where you have a job for everyone that you can't do something that really does help some people to be able to both in the short and the long term have better employment prospects than they may otherwise have.
What are the political prospects for a program like this? I would suspect that it might poll well because people like working rather than welfare. But is there anybody pushing for this in D.C. that we know of?
There are. In fact, in the president's infrastructure package, there is reference to subsidized jobs as being part of that. So, and there is also a bill that a number of senators, led by Senator Wyden, have put out. It's called the Jobs for Economic Recovery Act. So there is movement in Washington to actually have subsidized jobs be part of a recovery package to really try and, again, address the long-term unemployment, to try and really move and make sure we're moving in a direction of an equitable recovery.
To return to what we started with, I mean, we're going to probably see improving unemployment numbers in the coming months. Is that going to be a really accurate measure of how people are doing, or will there still be a lot of people falling through the cracks?
We know there will be a lot of people falling through the cracks. Now, we will have some evidence. I mean, what we would expect to see is we have seen long-term unemployment numbers that are quite high, and we expect those will continue, and those people are the people who may not move into the job market as quickly. And generally, we see people of color who are overrepresented in that group. So this is really a strategy that would really help that group of people and people who are left behind to move into the labor market.
That was LaDonna Pavetti, Vice President for Family and Income Support at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington. I have to say I still dream of a world where not so much emphasis is placed on competing in an unsubsidized job market. Also, I prefer a discourse that didn't describe poor people as left behind, but rather recognized that this is a system that produces marginalization by its very nature. But we listen to many voices here in Behind the News. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, some of Boat Song by the late 70s Swiss punk band Kleenex, which renamed itself Lilliput after legal threats by Kimberly Clark. Till next week, bye.